Today, what does the London Bridge terror attack tell us about our justice system? And Donald Trump returns to London.
So the first thing I saw was a short video.
What has he got on him? Knives? Man.
Three men grappling each other on London Bridge. One man had a fire extinguisher. There was smoke or steam blasting around this one individual who was sort of falling to the floor. And then there was another man with a long, sharp implement jabbing him, and it looked really confusing. It was really chaotic.
They used fire extinguishers. They used chairs. They used these narwhal tusks ripped off the wall in the heat of the moment.
It looked like there was a fight going on, and then you realise it was police wrestling with one tall, bearded man.
Because I knew it was on London Bridge, it had these awful echoes of what happened 2 years ago, and the first thing I thought was, oh gosh, this is another terror incident happening in exactly the same place.
What The Guardian's Home Affairs correspondent Jamie Grierson is describing is the end of a terror attack in which five people were stabbed and two, Saskia Jones and Jack Merritt, killed. The fact that the attacker was a convicted terrorist, released halfway through his sentence, has led to a stark debate about whether our justice system is fit for purpose. Boris Johnson has promised a draconian crackdown on sentencing. But David Merritt says his son Jack believed in rehabilitation, not revenge. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how should we respond to the London Bridge terror attack? We now know that the murderer, who was lying on London Bridge, shot dead by police, pictured with a tag around his ankle, was Usman Khan. He went to jail in 2012. What had he been doing before that?
Khan was arrested at the age of 19 in late 2010 for his role in an Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism plot. The plot involved him and eight others developing plans to set up a madrasa or a school training camp out in Kashmir. And the plan was to get recruits out to that camp and train them for terrorist activities back in the UK. And among that group of nine, they had discussed sites and targets in the UK, which included the London Stock Exchange. What we do know is that he was mixed up in extremism activities as young as sort of 14 at least. He was absorbing this material and he was also trying to sort of share it with others and preach the message out in the streets as well.
And clearly he came to the attention of the authorities. Do we know how they discovered what the group was doing?
The community in Stoke was raising concerns about not just him as an individual, but the groups that he was hanging out with. He was also a supporter or a member or had links to a now banned terror group called Al-Muhajirun, which was led by the sort of infamous street preacher Anjem Chowdhury.
Islam means istislam, submission. Submission to the commands of God in this life.
It's to fear Allah.
He was running stalls out in the local community and they were offering things like Islamic literature, leaflets, CDs, DVDs, that sort of stuff. Around the time when he was involved in these street preaching activities, BBC Midlands interviewed him and he denied that he was a terrorist of any kind.
And the older community knows me and they will know you. If you ask them, they will know, like, these labels, what they're putting on, like, terrorists, this, that. They will know I know terrorist.
So we know that he's quite a well-known figure in the area. We know that he was actually arrested by police. So we can be fairly sure that it was around this time that he was brought to the attention of security services and they would have been monitoring him and probably for a good sort of year or so up to the point of his arrest.
What did they charge him with and what do we know about the court case?
The court case is complicated and he was originally charged with the most serious terror offence you can be charged with, which is preparing for acts of terrorism, and that is punishable by life in prison. But he did deny that. And the defendants were allowed something called a Goodyear hearing. It allows the judge to discuss with the legal teams what the sentence might look like if they were just to plead guilty. And so Khan decided to plead guilty to a revised version of that charge. And it was revised into focusing what he was alleged to have done in relation to Pakistan.
So ultimately, he was charged with trying to fund madrasas in Kashmir that could have been training terrorists, but not with plotting to, for example, attack the London Stock Exchange.
Exactly, yeah. That was what he ultimately pleaded guilty to.
Much of the debate that we're hearing now is around his sentence. What was that?
Initially, he was sentenced under a regime designed to give dangerous prisoners a minimum term, but no maximum term. And it was used when life sentences weren't available to them. And in Khan's case, he was given a minimum term of 8 years, minus the days he did on remand, which is 408. The regime was introduced by the Labour government in the mid-2000s, and it was later proven to be a disastrous policy in terms of the fact that these people were put in prison for minimum periods with no release date. And it was intended for the most dangerous offenders, but it was widely used. There were examples of people who had stolen mobile phones being jailed under this type of sentence, doing 10, 11, 12, 13 years in some cases.
Because basically there's no maximum term in order to protect society from people who are considered to be dangerous.
Exactly. So in the end, it was much more widely used than expected. They thought that it would be applied to 300, 400 cases, and it ended up rocketing up to 9,000 plus. The Conservative Party in 2012 decided, let's scrap it.
But actually, the focus in this case isn't that original open-ended term. It's why Khan was later let out of prison. And that's because he appealed and a judge changed it for a so-called extended sentence. That had a time limit, in his case of 16 years. But also, and I think this is the really controversial point, an automatic release from prison at the halfway mark. So Khan was let out of jail after 8 years to serve the rest of his sentence within society. And the parole board wasn't involved in that decision. Why did the previous Labour government introduce that type of sentence?
In the middle of the 2000s, the prison population was soaring, prisons were overcrowded, and the parole board was overwhelmed. And this was a way of alleviating some of that burden on both those bodies.
Cost-cutting.
Some cost-cutting, yeah. But there is evidence to show that being rehabilitated in the community is more effective than being rehabilitated in prison. So there was that element to it as well.
Okay, well, we're going to come to what went wrong at each step of the journey for Usman Khan. But just before we did, Boris Johnson and his Home Secretary, Priti Patel, have repeatedly said that Labour is to blame for Usman Khan's sentence and release date. Is that correct?
No, they're not right to blame Labour entirely. The Court of Appeal at the time could have kept him on that same sentence. He would still have been serving that sentence this date, and he would have been subject to parole board's assessments to determine whether or not he could have been released. They did change the rules at a later date, so you were released at the two-thirds point with parole board assessment. But I think the thing that's really important is that Johnson and Patel's focus is entirely currently on sentencing and early release. And it's avoiding a conversation or a discussion around the much broader factors which apply to Khan's case.
Right, so not just sentencing, but what actually happens when someone's in prison and then afterwards in terms of probation, monitoring and rehabilitation. Has austerity affected those areas?
We know that since 2010, the Ministry of Justice's budget has been cut by around 40%. If it's not the most significant cut to a departmental budget, it's certainly one of the most significant cuts to a departmental budget.
Let's talk about him going into prison.
He was sent to Belmarsh Prison, which there has been plenty of reports about problems with radicalisation, re-radicalisation or grooming by Islamic radicalists within that jail. We know that prisoners spend significant periods of time in their cells. They're up to 22, 23 hours a day. So there's very little rehabilitative activity, access to workshops, educational programmes. We know now that while he was in jail, he was requesting assistance for de-radicalisation. Well, we know this through his lawyer.
He recognised that his extreme violent ideology was wrong. He wanted to correct himself.
There, he did take part in the programme for rehabilitation. Do we know what these programmes look like?
They're relatively secretive for security reasons normally, but some of them involve faith leaders. So they'll have imams who will come and talk about, you know, interpretations of the Quran and so on, and where there are differences or misinterpretations, they can sort of talk about that. There's not much evidence that they have brought about significant changes to the people who've engaged with those programs. And over that period that Khan was in jail, that service was being cut back.
When was he actually released?
So he was released in December 2018, and by that stage he had done 8 years in prison. If you include that period he was in remand, that long 408-day period that he was in custody before his trial, and that would have been an automatic release at the halfway point.
So were there any checks on him at that point when he was walking out of prison?
There were no assessments as the parole board would have done, but the principle would be that he would have been engaging with services both behind bars and then out in the community. How extensive that engagement was, we don't have the answer to.
And you can probably see then why people would worry about that moment, because it seems to me that if somebody has been engaging in terrorist activity, that I'd feel a lot more comfortable with the parole board being involved in the decision to allow them to leave jail.
Yeah, you can absolutely understand people's concerns around that area. We're supposed to be able to have faith in the services that he was handed over to also, the mental health services and the monitoring of security services and police. And also we were supposed to have confidence that the time he spent in prison had been productive in rehabilitating him.
Before we go into some of the things that happened afterwards, that 40% cut to the Ministry of Justice budget that you were talking about, how devastating has that been for the services Khan would have been walking into at this point?
The overhaul of the probation sector, the sector that's involved in the monitoring and supervising of offenders in the community by the Conservative government, is broadly considered to be, and this is not my opinion, this is the opinion of experts, including the inspectorates, the Justice Select Committee, academics, it's broadly considered to be one of the biggest policy disasters of the last 9 years.
Okay, so Khan is let out of jail, but he's still serving this extended sentence because this sentence spans time in jail and time on license outside. We know now, because of those dramatic images, that he had a tag around his ankle. Can you tell me how that works?
The tag would simply be to monitor exactly where he is, his movements, and that he's not stepping out of any areas that he's not supposed to be in. He was on something called a MAPA. It's another acronym for you. It's a multi-agency public protection arrangement. And these are used for either prolific or really dangerous offenders. And what they do is they bring together, as it says, a multi-agency approach to monitoring this individual in the community. And what are those agencies? Those agencies will be the probation sector, but it could also include mental health services, local authorities, and it could involve law enforcement agencies as well.
And do we know whether it did involve that? Because arguably, knowing where Usman Khan is in the country doesn't mean anything if you can't get into his head and understand that he wants to take a knife and murder people.
Yeah, well, this comes back to the argument about what's happened to the probation sector over the last 9 years. There's evidence to show that there's relatively inexperienced probation workers given huge bookloads of offenders to deal with at any one time. And so they have to have these quite brief meetings, sometimes done over the phone. And it's arguably not enough to really, as you say, like get into the mindset of an individual. It's more of a box-ticking exercise.
And the greatest irony of all of this appears to be the event that Usman Khan was at in London, presumably the reason he was allowed to London.
Yep.
What was that event?
So he was at this Learning Together event. It's a rehabilitation education-focused initiative that's led by Cambridge University. I understand he was not allowed in London as part of some of the conditions of his monitoring, but had been given an exemption for that one day just to be able to attend this course. He'd already been out of prison for a year, and I understand the security services considered Khan to be a low to medium priority threat anyway. You know, they couldn't have had any immediate concerns that he was going to do what he did.
And I guess the fact that they were at this event in which he had offenders alongside campaigners, alongside experts from the criminal justice world, is how we had this weird twist to the story. That among those chasing Khan down, one with an ornamental narwhal tusk and another with a fire extinguisher, was James Ford, who it turned out was a prisoner on day release. Why had he been jailed?
James Ford murdered somebody. He murdered a woman. He strangled and stabbed her. And he was sentenced to a life prison sentence, as all murderers are. At this stage in time, he's been moved to an open prison in Kent. And that is standard practice when someone is coming to the end of their minimum term on a life sentence. He would have been at that event to engage with the rehabilitation focus of that event. The family of Amanda Champion, who he's murdered, have urged people not to view him as some sort of hero, and that's to be expected. It's also the case that this is an example of somebody who's engaging with rehabilitation in a positive way, and he's attended that event like a significant number of the other offenders who would have been at that event because they want to turn their lives around.
This whole event came less than 2 weeks before a general election. But after barely a pause in the campaign, fingers of blame were being pointed in all directions. Boris Johnson has been accused of politicising the deaths. What's he said?
Johnson has been on the airwaves this weekend. Other members of the cabinet have been on the airwaves this weekend promoting their policy changes and their plans to toughen up sentencing and to lock up terrorists for longer, all in the context of this specific tragedy.
Well, I do think there is an issue, as I've said, about automatic early release. I think it's wrong for serious sexual offenders. I think it's wrong for violent offenders. I think it's wrong for terrorists.
And one of the responses has been a panic over other convicted terrorists who have been released. Do we know how many?
Boris Johnson said over the weekend he thought it was about 74, and it is a concern. It's a concern for law enforcement agencies, and it's a concern for security services that not only are they having to monitor individuals who haven't yet reached that criminal threshold, they're also having to monitor individuals who they know have been convicted of terrorist offences and are now back out in the community.
What are you doing about them now?
The 74 other individuals who've been let out early on the basis of this Labour change to the legislation, they are being properly invigilated so as to ensure there is no threat
so when
to
you
the
heard
public.
This,
and,
you were,
and we took that action.
So when you heard this, you were concerned that this kind of thing could happen again and again and again.
And already after a review of these sentences, two people have been taken back into prison. But there is a very different side to this. We've talked about Khan's victims, Saskia Jones and Jack Merritt, for whom there have been loads of tributes.
We come together this morning as Londoners to remember, to honour and to mourn.
She wouldn't want people to be sad. She was just such a happy person. You literally, if you went in a room with her, even if you were in tears, you'd leave happy. She just had so much love to give.
So it's not fair. This world has changed.
He really believed that the work that Learning Together is doing is fundamental for the future of our society.
Both were at a conference as people volunteering and working in rehabilitation. Jack's father, David Merritt, has already said he doesn't want his son's death to be used to justify more draconian sentences. And yesterday he wrote an incredibly powerful piece for The Guardian, suggesting that Jack would be seething at his death and life being used to perpetuate what David has called an agenda of hate. He said Jack would want people to follow his lead into a world where we don't lock up and throw away the key or give indeterminate sentences. Instead, we heard Justice Secretary Robert Buckland suggesting that some people are beyond rehabilitation.
Very often, terrorists and extremists harbour deep and long-held hatreds. They can display superficial signs of compliance. They can be manipulative. They can, in effect, hoodwink trained professionals. And I'm afraid we have to be very clear-eyed about this type of offender.
I mean, that underlines, I think, the Tories' total lack of interest in that side of dealing with criminality. You can keep arguing and arguing to just lock people up forever, but it's problematic. There are only very few people who get locked up for their whole life. There's something called a whole life order, and it's reserved for the absolute most serious violent offences. Had Usman Khan survived and been sent to prison, he could have been facing a whole life order for these two murders of Saskia Jones and Jack Merritt. But the reality is the vast majority of prisoners still have to come out at some stage, and the reasons for that are complicated. prisons would overflow. We're already one of the most incarcerated nations in Europe. And also it costs a lot. And that's a brutal reality. That's why we don't lock people up forever. So you have to have a more nuanced approach to this and think, how can we rehabilitate these people?
How do the Tory and Labour responses compare?
Conservatives are narrowly focusing on sentencing and early release. They're focusing on the punitive. And it's a relatively easy conversation for them to have. Legislation can be changed to send people to prison for longer. You have the appearance of being tough and clamping down on these awful atrocities. And it tends to work well with broad swathes of the electorate. Labour are saying the world's more complicated than that and you need to address the rehabilitative issues.
When those public services are cut back, as they have been during the past decade of austerity, they leave behind huge gaps. And that can lead to missed chances to intervene in the lives of people who go on to commit absolutely inexcusable acts.
Jeremy Corbyn is getting into some of the causes behind this kind of behaviour, and he's going right back and looking at British foreign policy and the response to the Iraq war and those sort of issues.
Well, we do a number of things. One, properly fund our prison service so that the prison officers are able to do their job, both being prison officers as well as educators, as well as people that deal with dangerous prisoners who've committed very dangerous, very serious offences. Secondly, that there be a psychological assessment of somebody in his situation before they are released. And after that, we have a probation service worthy of the name.
Both parties are definitely politicising the issue. I think it was Labour who actually first off the marks to start trying to talk about police numbers on Friday night. And then it moved into this issue about sentencing and automatic release from the Conservative Party.
Is all of this reflected in the manifestos?
The two manifestos present two different offers when it comes to crime and justice. So the Conservatives are going fully down the punitive route. There's tough talk on crime, tougher sentences, increased stop and search, let's build more prison places, all that kind of stuff. What they're ignoring is causes of crime. So, you know, Home Office evidence shows, for example, in gangs, you know, that exclusion from schools, broad, complex social problems that need to be tackled, as well as having an effective punitive system. Labour is talking about investing in probation sector. They're talking about investing in prisons as well so that they have effective rehabilitation processes. If you bring in the Liberal Democrats, they looked at their manifesto as well. They offer even more than Labour to have on down that more progressive route, that sort of evidence-led route where they're looking for ways to reduce reoffending and so on.
Isn't the most heartbreaking part of this that the people who were murdered, Saskia and Jack, seem to be so committed to the idea that people could be rehabilitated?
It's such an emotional subject when people lose their lives, and terrorism is such an emotional subject. It's important just to take a step back and not lose sight of the value of being able to help and assist people to turn their lives around, and the importance of hope when dealing with offenders in giving them a chance to return to society, contribute in the best way they can.
Jamie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Grierson. Do go to the website to read David Merritt's impassioned piece about the response to his son's death. Coming up, politicians hold their breath as Donald Trump returns to London in the middle of a general election. Now, NATO describes itself as the most successful military alliance in history, and this week its annual leaders' meeting has brought a number of heads of states to London. Among them is US President Donald Trump, whose arrival is likely to shake up both the NATO summit and the UK general election, as our diplomatic editor Patrick Winter explains.
It's the first time that Johnson's really, as Prime Minister, had to host a big event like this. It's a test for him, but the strangest part of that test is the degree to which he can make the most powerful man on earth stay silent. One of Labour's largely successful attack lines has been to say that the trade talks will include changes to the NHS, medicines, pricing being increased, etc. And the last thing Boris Johnson wants is Trump to wade into that issue. And I think if he does speak at all at this summit, there will be a very large piece of paper in front of him saying the NHS is not on the table in any trade talks, and he'll be asked to read that out repeatedly. The real politics will be whether he tries to attack the Brexit deal that Boris Johnson's trying to get through Parliament and what this election is largely about. I mean, obviously, Trump is very close to Farage, Nigel Farage, the Brexit leader, and Farage is still attacking that deal, saying it's not going to make the UK sufficiently independent and it might make trade deals with America impossible. And Trump listens to Farage, and it's just possible he will echo what Farage says rather than what Johnson says, and that would be embarrassing for Johnson, whose whole method through this election is really to be as risk-free as possible and to avoid controversy. There are plenty of other people that the president could attack at this summit, which would perfectly well preoccupy him and keep him in the headlines, but not in the domestic UK headlines. I mean, he could take fire at Macron, the French president, because of the way in which he's trying to build a stronger European defence arm, and Trump feels that America is going to be excluded, its companies are going to be excluded from that. He could equally have a huge row with the Turkish president, Erdogan, because Erdogan has decided to buy some Russian defence missiles, which the American military said that if Turkey go ahead with that purchase of the Russian defence system, it really puts the whole question of Turkey's membership of NATO at risk. I could also imagine, just because of the backdrop of the terrorist incident last week, that the London mayor, Sadiq Khan, someone who Trump's regularly sends off a Twitter tirade to, will be in his line of sight. Last time he called him a stone-cold loser, and you can see him saying something similar again. The absolute best outcome is that Trump doesn't open his mouth, that he doesn't look at his phone and hit the Twitter button, and he leaves on Wednesday night smiling but totally opaque as to what he thinks about either the UK election or about NATO. But that sort of feels like it's not in Trump's nature. And I think it's always less than flattering to be told that the best way you can help me in an election is if you say nothing at all. I mean, if you look at America, Trump loves going around quite medium grade elections, governorships, endorsing the Republican candidate, making speeches for them. And whether it succeeds or not, he believes he brings home a bacon for somebody. And it would be tough for him to be told that actually you're so unpopular in the UK that no one wants to hear from you. It's best if you keep quiet. That's the way you're going to help somebody. And it's also just against his nature to show that kind of self-restraint. It's just not the man he is.
That was Patrick Winter. My thanks to him and to Jamie Grierson. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.